So I'm Kristen, I'm an alcoholic, and let me give you my stats. I got sober on January 1st, 1990, which means I'll be coming up on 27 years this coming January, which is crazy. And much like many of you here, I was young. I was 17 years old. And the thing that was true for me is I probably wouldn't have lived to see my 18th birthday, but I'll get to that in a minute. I have a home group, which is on the Upper East Side. I'm not in business attire, so I'm not going to say what it is. I'm supposed to be dressed in business attire, but I do have a home group. Super, super important. And if for those of you who know I'm talking about, you will get a kick out of that, which group I'm talking about. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Bonnie, and she has a sponsor, and her sponsor has a sponsor. And, you know, I feel very fortunate that I'm in a sober family that really lives in solution, because it saved my life in long-term sobriety. So let me just tell you why I qualified to be here. And I'm just curious, how many people here are under 25? And how many under 18? Okay, I was under 18, so I was 17. So, you know, the cool thing is, and for the rest of you, you're just old. No, I'm just kidding. The cool thing is there's a real gift here in this room, and that gift is somehow all of us listened to whatever that little tiny spark was to get help, you know? And there's so many people out here in this world that won't listen to it. Like, I actually don't like that saying, but for the grace of God, because I think but for the grace of God, it can be taken as, oh, like some people got grace and some people didn't. But the truth is that I think everybody has that moment where you hear that little thing that says, yeah, this could be better and this could be different and I don't have to live this way. And the people sitting in this room heard this early in life. And I know you don't get it yet, but you will. Your life could be just unbelievable now. You have so many opportunities in front of you. And so so I'll tell you how I qualified. You know, I picked up, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. You know, I grew up in a very white Catholic west side of Cleveland in this area called Bay Village, Ohio. And everybody looked the same and talked the same and walked the same. And I was a big gay girl, you know, who liked to wear boys' clothes in this area. So, like, from the get-go, I never felt like I fit in. And I think my disease loves that. My disease loves to, like, get a hold of anything that tells me I'm different and that tells me I'm not okay. So here I was in the west side of Cleveland, and I grew up, you know, very, very cookie-cutter world. You know, and I picked up my first drink at 12, and my instinct with alcohol from day one was never, I'll tell you the background. So I went to a wedding, sitting at a 10 top, there were 10 glasses of champagne around it, and for some reason people didn't like their champagne, and they said, Kristen, would you like our champagne? Well, I thought, sure, I don't really know what this is, and all I know is I saw people pick it up and sniff it and sip it, and I didn't really feel drawn to do that. I just kind of picked it up and threw it back like a shot, and then went and proceeded all the way around the table. And there's a video of me somewhere in a pink dress suit with a cast up to here on my arm because I'd fallen out of a tree 2 weeks prior, spinning on a dance floor, drunk, because, you know, I didn't sip champagne. I threw it back like Jack Daniels. Like from day one, I loved the effect. It got me out of that thinking, you know, that alcoholic thinking I could see before I ever picked up a drink, you know, that feeling restless, irritable, discontent, not feeling like I belonged, feeling like my skin didn't fit, you know, whatever it was that the message of the day to tell me I wasn't okay, you know, and it eased that. And then, you know, so, and I remember that night, my father, who's also in recovery, sat in his car, and I was sitting in the behind him, and he's in the driver's seat, and I remember looking down below his seat, and there was this blue book that said Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember this as clear as day, and I looked up at him, and he looked back at me, and he said, you drink the way I drank. Like, he saw it from day one, right? So, like, and I was a mess. I drank, and I always say it's not my job to diagnose someone, but, like, it's kind of like going, if you go to another country, and, you know, your first language is English, and you hear someone speak English, all of a sudden, like, maybe you're in Spain, and everybody's speaking Spanish, and all of a sudden you hear English, you can't help but understand it. You know what I mean? So when I see somebody drinking alcoholically, it's not my job to diagnose them, but I can't help but notice, you know? So that's the way I started drinking, and, you know, I drank in high school, and I always say, and I think everybody here will identify with this, you know, I didn't lose a family and a car and a job and all that stuff. I lost everything relative to my age. Went from an A student to a D student, had a lot of disciplinary problems in school, almost got, you know, I went to this all-girls Catholic high school, and I, you know, the first year they were like, why do you even want to be here? I was like picking fights with teachers and getting kicked out of classes, and you know, you had to apply to get into the school. It wasn't easy to get into, and I was there, and they were like, you know, do you even want to be here? And they let me stay going on probation, and I had to go see a therapist. And the funny thing is my mom randomly picked this therapist because she had heard she was good with teenagers. Well, she was a recovering alcoholic and a lesbian, so it was like a home run for me as a kid trying to figure everything out in my life. So that was very good for me. And I'll never forget, at 14 years old, when she asked me, could you be an alcoholic? And I remember going, and excuse my language, I said, fuck you. I'm 14 years old. How could I possibly be an alcoholic? Because I thought of alcoholics like my dad and like people who are older and bums and like, how could a teenager possibly be an alcoholic? But, you know, going through those years, because I really want to talk about the solution and what it's like to be in sobriety. It's really simple. It was the effect of alcohol. When I picked up a drink, I could not stop. And in between drinks, I was even a bigger mess. Like, all I did was think about drinking, and I didn't care about soccer. I was a very good athlete. I didn't care about any of the sports. Scholarships didn't matter. School didn't matter. All I cared about was drinking and, you know, and using the dry goods if I could get a hold of them. So it was all about getting out of myself. That became the most important thing. And, you know, the Big Book talks about different kinds of drinkers. I was definitely the suicidal variety, right? Like, I got depressed. I hated my life. I didn't want to live. Well, going through my freshman year all the way up to my junior year, I drank. I went from the weekend warrior to the daily drinker. And, again, lost a lot of different things. Almost got kicked out of school on several occasions. And then I got caught drinking, and I said, you know, maybe I'm an alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. But I wasn't really ready to get sober. I just did it to get I thought it would get me out of trouble. And it kind of did, but not really. But when I was 16 years old, my best friend's name was Molly. And Molly had a brother named John, and John was 17. He was a year ahead of us. And John was about 6'3 and this big, tall, skinny Irish kid, kind of goofy, kind of gangly. And I was on the soccer team, and I remember John coming up to me one day. Molly didn't play soccer. John came up to me, and he gave me this big hug, and he said, Kristen, I love you. He said, take care of my sister Molly for me, always. Promise me that. And I said, yeah, all right, man, that's cool, whatever. And I, like, smacked him in the head and just gave him a hug and really didn't think anything of it. And fast forward, 2 weeks later, he had cleaned out his locker. He had written notes. He had jumped off a bridge at 17. And, you know, and this is certainly not to say anything about age, but trust me, when you look back, I'm 43 now, when you look back, you realize you know nothing when you're 17. You really, like, you don't even understand how good life could be and how much solution there is out there and opportunity. And in his notes that he wrote, he apologized for being an alcoholic. And he really believed that there was no hope for him. And I saw firsthand the aftermath of a suicide. And I was that kind of kid who was could go to a really, really dark place. And the only silver lining in that was that it prompted me to ask for help when the time came and I was really ready to, you know, take a bunch of pills and just end it myself. I couldn't get the images of John's family, his mother kissing his casket, his sisters freaking out, like the whole family and what it did to them. And my friend was never the same when she lost her brother. That family was never the same after they lost John. And, you know, they were robbed of him because of alcoholism. And that's this disease. This disease doesn't care if you're black, if you're white, if you're tall, if you're fat, if you're skinny, what your nationality is, if you're rich, if you're poor, it'll just take you out. Doesn't care, you know? And that is what I've learned. So I ended up getting sober January 1st. I checked myself into rehab. I asked for help. And, you know, for me, again, I went from the weekend worry to the daily binge. But the thing that really really made me realize that I had a real problem. Is even though I couldn't, I definitely couldn't stop. But the way it just rotted my soul in between the drinks and getting high as well, it really rotted my soul. And they talk about the alcoholic thinking and the untreated alcoholism. Like I was just sick, and that was 1990. That was 1990. And now I want to talk about what it is to stay sober, because how much. 15 minutes. Oh, good. That was perfect. Good. Because I want to spend 15 minutes talking about long-term sobriety. So I'm 26 and a half years away from a drink and any kind of drug or any kind of mood-altering substance. I'm on nothing. I'm not on antidepressants, and I have no opinion on that. I'm just saying for me, I'm just not on anything. And if I eat too much sugar, I get a little cuckoo, but like that's pretty much the extent of it now. And, 26 and a half years later, I have been close to this program. And I have been far away from this program. Early sobriety, I went to college, I stayed sober, didn't really connect with AA all that much, was a little crazy, had fun, whatever. I did almost relapse a couple times, and I was able to see kind of the way they talk about the allergy and like if alcohol gets into your system. I was at soccer camp, we were training. Now, it's the middle of the day, we're in between training sessions, and one of my teammates hands me what I think is Gatorade, and it's spiked with vodka. I had no idea we were in training camp. So I take a swig, and I was like, what was in that? That set off cravings in me that I couldn't believe. Like, I wanted to go and relapse. Like, a couple weeks later, I wanted to go out and drink, but I was able to ask for help. So it's like if you think, like, if you're in the situation, it very well could happen in long-term sobriety where you've picked up the wrong drink accidentally, you didn't know it, it's the same kind of matching drink, or somebody put something in a drink that they didn't know. You know, the craving, even just a little alcohol slipped into your body can do is really dangerous. So I will just put that out there. If I had gone and drank, it would have been a relapse, but I genuinely did not know anything was in that drink, which is a big difference. A relapse really takes place as a decision before you actually put that in your body, right? So that's a little thing. So I got through college, though. I went there, and, it wasn't so easy, but I did it. And life went forward. And the first 10 years of my sobriety, I got the six-figure job. I got the Bernese Mountain Dogs. I got a luxury SUV. I got the girlfriend. Life got really big and cool. It's like kind of what you're supposed to do. Like, now that I'm sober and I'm that good kid, I better have the good career, right? And I stopped doing what this program taught me to do. This program from day one taught me be of service, get a sponsor, go through the steps, and carry the message forward. I cannot keep it if I don't give it away. And from day one, it's that simple, right? It's that simple. And live in steps 10 and 11 and 12. That's what I was taught. Live in 10, 11, and 12 because that maintains my spiritual condition. It's kind of like going to the gym. I can't expect to keep a six-pack if I'm not going to the gym and I'm eating popcorn, which I'm doing a lot these days. But, it's like I can't expect to be in shape. So, like, my spiritual state in sobriety, there's no way it's going to stay fit if I'm just not working on it on a daily basis. Am I perfect? Absolutely not. No, not at all. But I try. I make best efforts. But so anyhow, so the life got big, and I got a really good job and all this stuff. And then I was like, okay, my sponsor moved to L.A., and I thought, oh, I'll get a sponsor tomorrow. And then, I was busy at work. I was very important, by the way. Very important in my mind. So it's very important. And so I'd go to a meeting tomorrow. And I never, ever, ever made a decision that I didn't want to go AA and that I didn't want to go to AA, nor did I not want to work this program. But life got so big that very slowly but surely, a day at a time, I stopped doing what was in this program. And next thing I knew, by year 16, I did not have the girlfriend. I had the dogs. I had the SUV that I'd love to have gotten rid of because I got a couple car accidents and it cost a fortune to carry. I hated my job. I was hanging out with super unsavory people, people who were not sober, people who were smoking bones in front of me, people who were drinking in front of me, people who were actually connected to mob, so like really unsavory folks. I got conned out of money, like a total 180 of what I would find in these rooms. But what was interesting is because I unplugged from AA and I stopped doing what I wanted to do, money, sex, and power became my higher power. It's really simple. Loved money, sex, and power. That's it. And that was my driving force, and that made me really, really sick. So by year 16, all this stuff had come into my plate, and I looked around, and I felt as suicidal as I did when I was 17 years old, and I wanted to die. And I remember sitting in a, and here's what happens in long-term sobriety. There's another piece. God, if I tell people that pretend you're sober, if I tell people I'm thinking this, they're going to think like I'm a bad sober person, or I can't tell people I'm having issues. I'm supposed to be a rock. I'm supposed to be this. Well, here's the thing: the longer I stay sober, the more I need to work this program. And I've watched people go out at 10, 15, 20 years and die. We just buried a friend of mine a few weeks ago, 35 years old, just couldn't get this, had some sobriety. You know, it's like we can get it in here. We're not always guaranteed to come back. You know, I have buried so many friends in this program because this disease is no joke. And they thought they had it, and they didn't have to do what this program requires. You know, it worked for me. And, where was I going with that? Long-term sobriety. So anyhow, the thing is it's so, so important to stay plugged in here. And I remember at 16, I was sitting in a meeting. I was so, so suicidal. I was 16 years sober, and I was scared to death to tell anybody I was having issues in long-term sobriety. Because I didn't want to look bad, because I'm me. Don't you know who I am? And I finally raised my hand, and I said, I need a sponsor. Boom. This woman, I was over in Jersey City, and this woman, who I am so grateful for, walked over to me and said, please come to my home group. I went to my home group. She walked me up to my current sponsor, who has now sponsored me for a long time, 10 years? It's about that. Wow, it's crazy. She walked up to me. Now Bonnie, if anybody's ever been to the Atlanta group and you know Bonnie, Bonnie is this little Jewish woman who looks like Bette Midler, and she is a sassy little thing, but she works a hell of a program. She looked me up and down, and Robin said, hey, Bonnie, Kristen's looking for a sponsor. And she looked me up and down, and she said, call me tomorrow at 9:30. And I said, okay. She wouldn't even give me her cell phone number. I don't have the home number. So I called her at like 9:40 because I was very busy with my job and clearly very, very important. And she said, I told you to call me at 9:30. And I said, yeah, well, you know, I'm busy. And I whatever, you know. And she said, let me tell you something. You're so big and fucking important. She goes, you drink, you die. There are people in that meeting who are much more important than you are. And I just thought, whoa. Like, all right, this is the woman for me. That's what I needed. I needed to be told that I really wasn't as big as I believed as I was, you know, could be, you know, as important as I am. Because that's just my alcoholic ego. So I began a beautiful journey with Bonnie. And that was in 2005. God, it's been 11 years. It's not even 10 years. It's 11 years. That was in 2005, fall of 2005. And I remember when I started working with her, I had this girl I wanted to get back together with. And so I told her, I'm like, okay, so we're going to work with steps in 90 days. I'm going to be able to make amends to my ex, and then everything will be fine. And Bonnie was like, okay, let's see how that goes. It took me a year to actually get through the steps again. And the beautiful thing about it was, as I plugged back into a higher power, I redefined my God, a God that I grow, you know, whatever you want to call it, HP, or higher power. I grew with that again. I started doing the steps, and the steps started changing me again. And all of a sudden, I craved serenity, and all of a sudden, I wanted to be kind, and all of a sudden, I wasn't as important as I thought I was, and all of a sudden, me caring just about what I get out of something started to change. I cared about what you got out of something. And I always say, the thing I looked for in the bottom of a drink was peace, right? That's it. That's all I wanted. And I didn't ask for help because necessarily I wanted to stop drinking. I asked for help because I wanted to stop hurting, always. And so the steps for me actually started to unfold things in a way where that peace and serenity started entering into my life very, very slowly. Went through the steps. Work 10, 11, I get a sponsee, and I take, and I watch, and I get the first sponsee who says, I'm never praying. Okay, now is at peace with your higher power, watching that whole thing unfold. Sponsee after sponsee after sponsee that I get to carry the message to, and I get to see them change, and I get to see their lives come back, and I get to see them have peace, and, you know, and that's what I've always looked for. Now in sobriety, stuff happens, man. I got to tell you, I have had, how much time do I have now? Perfect. All right, perfect. And I'll, yes. So I've had a lot of stuff happen in sobriety, long-term sobriety. That is one piece. I have lost dogs. I have met the love of my life, and I married her. In fact, my sponsor, Bonnie, married us, which was pretty cool. I almost died. I had a heart condition that has been corrected. We'll see how long I last, but it's been corrected. It's kind of one of those things. You know, it's been corrected, and hopefully, you know, it'll continue to be corrected over the next course of my life. So there's so many things in life where I've been faced with, I could drink, or I could live in fear and make a big fucking mess, or I could try and do what this program teaches me and just show up and be in service and share my fears with my sponsor and pray and ask God to help me. And, you know, through everything, you know, I've literally faced my mortality not knowing if I'm going to get off a table. And there was a sense of, I think because of this program, I like knew I was going to be okay no matter what. No matter what. Which is kind of crazy. I lived through 9/11. I was here during 9/11. I watched people fall out the buildings. You know, I've been here. I've been here and I've lived life. And I've lived in good and I've lived in not so good. I now have a little boy who is, to me, the best thing since sliced bread. He is just delicious. He's 3 and he's funny and he's smart and he's got curls like, what's that god, that Greek god? He's got big curls and he's just handsome and he's funny and... Yes, Zeus. Yeah, is that it, right? Is that what you said? Yeah, okay. So, like, he's just, and you know what? That's what I think. Maybe you won't, but that's what I think. And, you know, but the thing is I get to have that. Like, I get to be here today, you know, and it's because of this program. You know, there's so many people who need this program that will not walk through that door. I can promise you. They'll never walk through that door. And, you know, we're like, I always say we're a part of a bunch that's like this big. We're like this big. That actually get to be here. And there are days I don't want to do this program. I struggle with every day. Oh, Kristen, go to a meeting tomorrow. I think I will always struggle with that. It's just my disease. But like then I pick up the phone or I get to a meeting or I call my sponsor. And, you know, life is a lot better. And I feel it's my responsibility to pay this forward. Because life can unfold in a really beautiful way. Despite challenges and despite things we don't want, it can unfold in a beautiful way. And we get to get a lot of gifts, too. You know, I get to be the sister and the mother and the daughter and the friend that people want to have around. And to me, that's a big deal. I don't want to be alone. I love my family and everything. So I'd love to hear from all of you. I'm really honored to be here, and I'm just so grateful that for those of you who got this at a young age, you just have so much in front of you. Okay, thanks.
Never had a legal drink. Due to increased expenses, we passed the baskets twice in order to meet our